There is probably one more thing I should mention about the midterm one at least, and then midterm two. Students usually start 7A with a, how should I put it, with a grasp on numbers that they just don't want to, they loathe to let go. Part of the purpose of 7A is to have you transition over. And so that until by the end of the class, you'll be comfortable with variables. Part of that reason, actually most of that reason, is because in 7B, you'll be asked to do problems in which you'll be asked to basically construct integrals. And you can't do that type of problem with numbers. You have to do it in terms of variables. You know, this requires, in part, a degree of abstraction that, you know, students usually don't have at the beginning of the semester. But we would hope that you would have to the end of, at the end of the semester. That's also why, for example, I only do problems with variables, and also a lot of the worksheet problems are in variables. There's very few, actually, that's in numbers. And that's why in the first midterm, there's about 2.5 problems with numbers in it. As we transition over in the second midterm, there'll be one problem with numbers in it, the rest being variables. And then when we get to the finals, you know, all the problems will be in terms of variables as opposed to numbers. That's just to get you used to working in variables as opposed to numbers all the time. Now on Tuesday, we basically got to there. Namely, we basically got all the equations we need when we're talking about point particles, the system of point particles as they interact with each other. And all that construction, all those equations are due to one single law, Newton's third, which is somewhat surprising if you think about it. Now, those are for point particles. Towards the end of this class, or at the very latest, the beginning of Tuesday's class, we're going to talk about extended bodies. These systems with more than just one part, more than just a few particles, but rather continuum particles. Not going to say that much about it, but I'll say a little bit about it. But just to give you guys a break from all the formalism and all of the, well, that, let me do a few examples first, mostly dealing with the demos on the counter. This one I won't talk anything more about other than show you. This is a series of collisions. It is, for example, believed to be a simple model of what supernovas would be. But basically, it's just, you know, five balls, each one with slightly smaller mass, right on top of each other. And when I drop it down, the first ball hits the ground, bounces up, collides with the second ball. Second ball then moves upwards, collides with the third ball. Third ball then moves upwards, colliding with the fourth ball. And each one, sequentially, each one, the ball gains more and more velocity. And we'll see what happens. I have to make sure I dropped it straight down. Ah, I didn't. Didn't fall straight down. Over here? Let me see if I can do it better. And let me see if I, by doing it at a smaller distance. Oh, close. I still can't release it straight. Sorry about that. Okay. But this is a series of collisions, one after another. Okay. And in each one, in each collision, each of the bodies gets more and more energy and more velocity as it comes out, because each body is slightly less massive. Now, this is a hard system to analyze. That is it. that's simply a two-body collision. One body coming in, colliding with a second body, then both moving off together. It's probably the simplest collision you can do, but it actually tells you quite a lot. We're doing this. These are two bodies of roughly the same mass. And once again, the air pressure is a little low. And what we're looking at is this. One body is at rest. The other body comes in. Oh, great. Air pressure is really low today. Okay. We won't do this demo. Air pressure is too low. But the idea is that you have one mass coming in, the other mass is at rest. They collide. In some way, somehow, they are connected together afterwards, and they move off together. Okay. This is an example of a totally inelastic collision. I'll tell you about the terminology in a minute. But in this example, something is conserved. In particular, momentum is conserved. Because when this body collides with this body, there is a force that this body acts, that this body exerts on the second one, along the horizontal line, that is. And there is an equal and opposite force that the first body exerts on the second. Or excuse me, that the second exerts on the first. In other words, all the forces along the horizontal line, if you discount friction, which we can't for this system, all the forces along the horizontal line are internal to the system. The system being the two carts. And because all the external forces are external, are internal to the system, that means that this is true, at least along the horizontal line. And since the sum of external forces to this system adds up to be zero, that means that momentum is conserved along the horizontal line. Now you'll notice that I didn't go directly into equations. I first asked myself what conservation law holds for the problem. These are relatively simple problems, so you don't have to do this. But later on, when we get into torques, for example, angular momentum, the system gets a little bit harder to understand and to analyze that way. Because momentum is conserved, I could talk about the initial state. In initial state, only the first mass, mass A, is moving. The second one, mass B, isn't, so its momentum is zero. So initially, there's only one momentum. After a collision, however, the two bodies move off as one. And because they move off as one, they both have the same velocity, VA plus B. So the final momentum of the system will be the total mass MA plus MB times VA plus B. And since all the forces on the horizontal direction, discounting friction, are internal to the system, momentum is conserved, and thus the initial momentum is equal to final momentum. Or MA VA equals MA plus MB VA plus B. So the final velocity is MA over MA plus MB VA. Now I should warn you that this chapter, chapter 9, is probably the most algebra intensive in the course. So there's a heck of a lot of algebra in here, as you'll see when I do this problem. But that's it, simplest possible problem. We use momentum conservation, and we didn't use energy conservation, in part because I couldn't guarantee that all the forces acting on between this body and this body are conservative. In fact, I couldn't determine. There was no reason I could ever give a priori that the forces that A acts on B and B acts on A will conserve energy. And because I can't tell you immediately at the very beginning that that is true, I can't use energy conservation straight off. Okay? So when you do get to one of these problems, do ask yourself, is energy conserved? Is momentum conserved? Before jumping right into the math. In fact, let me calculate the initial energy of the system, as a whole, being the energy of both masses. And let me look at the final energy of the system. Let's see if it's actually conserved or not. The initial energy is, well, only this one's moving, so it's 1/2 ma va squared. The final energy of the system is, well, now this combination is moving, and they both move at the same velocity. So this combination would have a total mass of ma plus mb times vab squared. Or, since I know exactly what vab is, from here I just calculated, I could plug into here. And when I do so, I find that it's 1/2 ma plus mb times ma squared over ma plus mb squared times va squared. And that means that if I look at the change in the energy of the system, delta E, which is always final minus initial. Okay? If you do initial minus final, you will get a sign error, which might come back and haunt you. That means the change in the energy of the system then would be this MA plus MD cancels out with one of these. So I get 1/2 MA squared over MA plus MB VA squared. That's the final energy. Minus 1/2 MA squared times VA squared. 1/2 MA VA squared, excuse me. Told you a lot of algebra. And noticing that 1/2 MA VA squared is common in both, you'll find that the change in internal energy of the system is 1/2 MA VA squared times the quantity. I still have MA left here. And I still have a 1 left here. And since MA over MA plus MD is a number that's less than 1, that means that delta E is less than 0. And the system lost energy in the collision. In fact, it lost the maximum amount of energy it could ever lose in this collision. This is a totally inelastic collision. Now, I'm not too big on terminology, but I am here because it has definite meaning. Elastic, an elastic collision, is one that conserves energy. It's a collision between two bodies for which the energy, final energy, equals the initial energy of the system. They're very rare. It doesn't happen that often, at least on the macroscopic scale. On the microscopic scale, they happen quite frequently because all forces are conservative, at the microscopic scale at least. An inelastic collision is one in which energy is not conserved. It's one in which energy is dissipated or added to the system. A totally inelastic collision is one in which the maximum amount of energy loss occurs in the collision. You can't lose any more than this. So between the two extremes of an inelastic collision here, where energy is conserved, and a totally inelastic collision here, in which the amount of energy loss in the system is maximal, this whole wide range of simply inelastic. And you can't tell. So usually in a system, either it's blatantly obvious that it's an elastic collision, or blatantly obvious that it's an inelastic collision, or else the problem will have to tell you energy is not conserved. One of the three. This is why, for example, momentum is more often conserved than energy, because of this effect. Now, when I was in your position, I looked at this and said, well, it's really, really, really simple. But now that I teach it, I realize it ain't that simple, at least physics. The reason why is I didn't tell you how these two bodies came to be connected after the collision. It could have been done to due to magnets, as it would here, if I had enough air pressure. It could have been done to a railroad car coupling between two railroad cars that come in, and they do a handshake like this afterwards, they move off. It could have been done due to Velcro on the two carts. It could have been done to a big wad of gum on the carts. Right? I didn't tell you, and it didn't matter. If this collision occurs, and if the two bodies are connected afterwards, the system will dissipate this much energy, period, irrespective of how the two bodies are connected. So on the flip side, that would mean that the two bodies will be connected if the coupling between the two carts is able to dissipate this much energy. If it isn't, the two bodies will just keep on going off their merry ways, and they won't be connected to one another. Everybody cool with that? Now, when I say inelastic, I simply mean that the system does not conserve energy. It doesn't mean always that energy is dissipated. It doesn't mean that the final energy is always going to be less than initial energy of the system. I have two examples of that here. There's a leaf spring between these two bodies here. And there's another leaf spring between these two bodies here. And the springs have been basically compressed. They're connected by a small string at the bottom. Now, when I light the fuse, when I light the string, it'll burn out, and then the spring will open. And this is supposed to mimic, in part, an explosion. Now, the leaf spring, right? This leaf spring interacts with the ball with a certain force. And for Newton's third, if the balls interact back with the leaf spring with equal and opposite force. So during the explosion where this leaf thing opens up, right, momentum is conserved along the horizontal line, at least, at that very one instant. Okay? But energy isn't. Because initially, there is no energy of the system, unless you want to talk about the potential energy of the spring. Okay? And at the end, both bodies will be moving that away. So this is a system in which we could say it's inelastic, right? Because initially it's not moving, finally both bodies are moving. Right? But energy is given to the system. It's converted from the potential energy of the spring to the energy of the kinetic energy of the balls. We talk about a spring, so we could talk about potential energy of the spring, but it could have been an explosion, or a true explosion, in which case, well, energy would be conserved, but mechanical energy wouldn't. It would be converting chemical energy into mechanical energy. Questions? Now, in this case, both balls were of the same mass, so the system went that away, right? And that one midpoint will always be, didn't move. The center of mass of the system doesn't move because, well, momentum is conserved. And since the momentum, the initial momentum was zero, the center of mass velocity of the body, of the system, is zero. So the center of mass never moved. Everybody cool with that? In this system, well, we have drastically different masses. We have a 7.39 grams mass here and a 1,775 gram mass here, okay? Which basically means that if you calculate the center of mass of the system, the center of mass will all be roughly here. Because remember what I said on Tuesday, center of mass is a weighted average. You'll be closest to the ones that have, the body has the bigger mass. So now when I do the explosion, that one moves. And it moves a heck of a lot to the right. Okay? That's because this is the lighter body. It took basically all the energy, right? And it moved a lot more to the right. And this one moved a tiny bit to the left, a really tiny bit. Okay. Questions? Yes, sir.
Didn't the center mass move that?
The short answer is no. Not for the whole system. Okay. And that's because the total momentum of the system, right, is zero, right? Initially, right? So its total momentum is zero at all times, right? That means that if you look at, remember, the total momentum is related to the center of mass velocity, how fast the center of mass velocity moves. If the total momentum is zero initially, it'll be zero at all times. That means that velocity of the center of mass will be zero for all time. That means the center of mass didn't move. The center of mass is roughly here, right, at the big mass, right? And that center of mass didn't move. Even though the big mass did move a little bit that way, that's because this one moved a lot this way. But their combination is such that the center of mass didn't move. Questions? Now let me look at the harder problem, the elastic collision problem. Okay, and in the process of doing this, I'll end up deriving an equation that you can use on the exams if you wish. In this problem, I have one car with velocity VA and mass MA, okay, traveling towards another car with velocity MB with velocity VB and mass MB. So what is the simplest condition you would have for a collision to occur? Yes, sir. That's right. The simplest example condition you would have to have before any collision occurs is that this one will eventually overtake this one. And thus, there will be a collision in the system. After the collision, they'll have velocity VA prime and VB prime. Okay? And I will tell you that the collision is elastic. And as such, energy is conserved in the system. Just telling you this. And once you say that, hey, energy is, the system is, collision is elastic, that means I can use conservation of energy in the system. And just like this system, whatever force that A acts on B, B acts back on A, at least along the horizontal line, and as such, momentum is conserved. So my initial state now is, well, the momentum of the first cart plus the momentum of the second cart. And I have a total energy of the system. Okay. Now, it doesn't matter when I measure this energy. Energy is conserved. So I'll make my life a lot easier. I'll measure this energy before the collisions, when the two bodies are separated from one another. In which case, there is no potential energy in the system. The two bodies have to hit each other before they exert a force on each other. So the only part of energy that's in the system now, at the very beginning, the only part is kinetic. In the final state here, the final momentum is MA VA prime plus MB VB prime, because both of them are moving. The final energy, now remember, this is after the collision, right? And once again, when it's after the collision, the two bodies are separated from one another. They don't exert a force on one another anymore, and thus there's no potential energy again for the system. And so that the final energy is the problem with using primes, of course, is that it's a pain rain down the square. And then you say to yourself, okay, I know momentum is conserved, I know energy is conserved, and thus this has to equal this. I also know energy is conserved, so this part has to equal this part. I don't know VA prime, I don't know VB prime. Two unknowns. And because of momentum conservation and energy conservation, I have two equations, which means two equations, two unknowns, I can solve. If you're looking at conservation problems, right? Momentum conservation can give you at most three equations, one for each direction. Energy conservation, if energy is conserved, can give you at most one equation. Okay. So it is possible, if the system conserves energy and all of momenta, to have to solve for four unknown variables. In this case, you only have two, which is already going to be a pain. Now, this is the solution of a linear equation with a quadratic, which, to tell you the truth, is a pain in the ass. Have you ever done it before? It's actually easier if you change this quadratic equation here, okay, and make it into a linear equation. Because once that happens, right, then you can use your usual stuff from systems of linear equations in high school to solve it. Now, to do so, to change this equation to a linear equation so you can solve it easier, what you want to do is move all the stuff with MAs on one side and all the stuff with MBs on the other side for both this equation and this equation. Let me do energy first. And let me first cancel out one all the one-halves. So if I want to move all the MAs to the right, I get MA VA squared from here minus MA VA prime squared from here. And that's equal to, well, this is still here, MB VB prime squared minus MB VB squared. And then, of course, I notice that these two terms have MA in common. So I'll take it out. And if you'll forgive me, I'll just do it that way. I don't have to write out another line. These two terms have MB in common. So I'll take it out. And then you reach into your recesses of all your memories from Algebra 1 or Algebra 2, and you realize that this is the difference of squares. So you can actually factor this. Namely, you could write the left-hand side as MA VA minus VA prime times VA plus VA prime. The product of these two gives me the first term. The product of these two gives me the second term with a requisite negative sign. And the cross terms, this times this would be positive, and you subtract off this times this. So the cross terms vanish. On the right-hand side, you do the same trick. It's MB VB prime now minus VB, since this is the first term and this is the second term, times VB prime plus VB. Questions? Well, you're almost there. See, we've isolated all the A's on one side and all the B's on one side for energy. Let's do it for momentum. Let me do it by moving this term over, so I get a MA VA minus MA VA prime for these two. And then let me move this term over to the right, I get MB VB prime minus MB VB for two. Just moving around the terms. And then I notice once again that MA is common, so, and MB is common, so I'll move them out. And then I say, lo and behold, this term is this. And this term is this. So let me get rid of those two terms. Let me divide the two equations. When I divide this one and this one cancel. And what I'm left with, VA plus VA prime. This one and this one cancel. VB prime plus VB. And you get a linear equation out, exactly what you want, or exactly what I want. Now, the book derives this as well. Okay? And I'll tell you straight out. that if there is a collision problem on an exam that's elastic, you can use this equation, okay, without having to prove it again. We just have to know how to use it. Questions? Yes, sir. Mostly for external forces. Now, I'll give you an example. Actually, I'll have one right there. Excuse me. Now, you end up having to solve this with this two linear equations. Now, I'm not going to solve it for you. I'll let you guys solve it in general. I'll give you the answer, though. I won't solve it for you in part because I'll start putting you guys all to sleep. It is early in the morning today. There's a lot of algebra that goes through. My recommendation when you solve these two equations in general is that you use elimination as opposed to substitution. It cuts down on the math tremendously that way. I will tell you this. That the answer is the following. That mess. Now, my suggestion is at one point within the next few days to sit down and actually solve those two equations. If for no other reason than practice. Okay. It is kind of messy, but you do notice that there is a symmetry here. You see, what I call A and what I call B was completely arbitrary. And if you notice that if you look at this equation, and everywhere there is an A, you change to a B. And everywhere there's a B, you change to an A. This equation will become this equation. Okay? So if you use the fact that how I label the problem was completely arbitrary, what I called A and B was completely arbitrary, and I did it in all generality, all you really have to do is solve for VA prime. And you get VB prime just by letting A goes to B and B goes to A. Now, the reason I want to write this out, put this out, is to look at a couple of limiting cases. Suppose that MA and MB are the same. In other words, the two bodies had the same mass. In which case, this term is zero. And this term will be 2 times MA plus 2 times MA. Because all of them have the same mass. 2M divided by 2M. That means that VA prime equals VB. And VB prime equals VA. In other words, the two just switch roles. Okay. Yes, sir? Where did you?
Right after the VA
prime. This is VA. My mistake. Sorry about that. So if they're extremely massive, right? the two completely switch roles. If they're, sorry, if the two are equal mass. If MB is much, much less than MA, like this situation, when there's one very light mass and one very heavy mass here, right? Well, in this case, VA prime becomes, because MA is much bigger than MB, I could forget about when I take MA minus MB, that's just a proxy equal to MA. MA plus MB will be a proxy equal to MA. So the ratio of this to this would be 1. And in this case, 2 times MB will be divided by MA, because MA plus MB is about equal to MA. And this would be something that's really, really small. Everybody cool with that? In fact, this is almost negligible. But if you look at this one, VB prime, the velocity of the lighter mass after the collision, right? Well, MA is much bigger than MB, so this will be 2MA divided by MA. This MA plus MB is about equal to MA. So it'll be twice VA. And this will be minus MA minus MA divided by MA again. 1 minus VB. So this one, the real heavy mass, its velocity won't change much at all. Which kind of makes sense. If you have a really, really big mass coming in, hitting a really small mass, then the really big mass, its velocity doesn't change much at all. In the movies, there'll be a Mack truck hitting a smart car, for example. Right? The Mack truck's velocity doesn't change much, but the smart car will go flying. It'll have roughly twice the velocity of the initial Mack truck as it comes in, minus its initial velocity, of course. Questions? Yes, sir. It isn't at all, okay? Not if you, see, this leaf was supposed to represent a chemical collision, a chemical bomb. Okay? So mechanical energy wouldn't be conserved because you're taking chemical energy and converting it into mechanical energy. Okay? So we'll say mechanical energy wouldn't be conserved at all. Initially the momentum is zero, finally everything's moving like crazy, right? If you want to, however, include a chemical energy of the system, then as a whole, chemical plus mechanical energy, that would be conserved. Other questions? In that case, let me do a twofer problem. This is the ballistic pendulum you have in your book. I'll do the demo and then I'll actually go through the analysis, because this is a problem in which you'll have two conservation forces. It's a 22 caliber rifle. It is loaded. Okay. It'll fire when I light the when I cock the rifle, light the fuse, it'll fire a bullet, the bullet will go into the block, and the block will rise to a certain height. Supposedly, this was an old way of determining muzzle velocity, the velocity of a bullet after a gun is fired. By measuring the height h that this block rises, you should be able to back out the velocity of the bullet when it left the gun, if you knew the mass of the bullet and the mass of the block. Okay? So let's see. I was told this is loud. I'm okay with it. So the first thing I do is cock the gun, re-aim the gun, and then light the fuse. ballistic pendulum. But you notice a couple of things. One is that this block did move up slightly, right? But this gun went to the right. Now, this gun went to the right because momentum conservation, right? Initially, there is no momentum. The momentum of the system is zero. Nothing's moving. After I fire the gun, the bullet's moving pretty damn fast to my left. Even though it has a small mass, it has a high velocity and thus a big momentum to my left. The rifle has a big mass. That's true. But because the momentum of the bullet was quite high, it does move to the right slightly. This one, on the other hand, the bullet comes in, hits the block. The block gains in velocity, and it moves upwards to a certain height. Now, to analyze the system, I actually like breaking it up into three parts. Okay? And it's here that you really have to start thinking about when momentum and when energy is conserved. Okay? Namely, in this system, I have a bullet moving at, well, let's call it some V0, and there's mass of the bullet. Right? And it's hitting a block. Right? And here's the strings to the block. Right? And this is immediately before the bullet hits the block. Immediately after the bullet hits the block, well, the block hasn't had time to move yet, but the bullet's embedded inside the block. I'll tell you that the block has mass, big M. And it's still being connected to the ceiling. That did. Then afterwards, the whole block moves. It moves upwards to here. And because it moves upwards, the string connected to the ceiling goes up like this. And I will tell you that the height that the block moves is H. See, this is, if you draw a series of pictures like this, you now see what's happening with the system. Because from here to here, well, this going from here to here is precisely this. It's one body moving pretty fast, hitting a body at rest. One car moving, hitting a car at rest. After collision, the original body and the body at rest move off together, just like it was here. So, during the collision, the bullet hits the block along the horizontal line. The block hits the bullet of equal and opposite force. But so between here and here, momentum is conserved. Simply because there's no external forces on the horizontal line. But because between here and here, well, between here and here, you notice that once the block leaves its resting position, it starts moving upwards. And once it starts moving upwards, there is the tension of the rope acting on the block. And as it moves upwards, the tension of the rope acting on the block will give a force on the block along the horizontal direction. Well, that tension on the rope, that rope is not part of the system. The system being the bullet and the block. And so that would be an external force. And as such, momentum is not conserved here. Because there will be an external force on the body, This is the example I was telling you about in which there is momentum not being conserved. But I do know that going from here to here, the only forces that does work on the body is gravity. Tension, of course, is always at right angles to the force, to the path the block takes. So tension doesn't do work. The only thing that does work is gravity, and thus energy is conserved. But once I realize that this system is exactly the same as this system, in other words, it's exactly the same as the cart system, then I know that this collision is totally inelastic. And I know from here that moment, that energy is not conserved in this collision. So in the whole ballistic pendulum problem system, there are two processes going on. First, the collision, and then the block rising upwards. In the first process, momentum is conserved, but energy is not. In the second process, energy is conserved, but momentum is not. So when you get a problem like this, and there's at least one problem like this, maybe two, in the workbook, always, always, always sit down, look at the process, and think, where is momentum conserved? Where is energy conserved? Before I start writing down equations. So I'll call this the initial state. This the intermediate state. And this the final state. And since I have to deal with potential energy due to gravity, I'll choose my origin right on top of the original block, right above it. Now, between here and here, I know momentum is conserved, so I have to write down momentum of the initial state. I also have to write down the momentum of the intermediate state, because I have to conserve momentum. I'll call the final velocity here, V. I know that energy is conserved between here and here, so I have to write down the energy of this intermediate state. In the intermediate state, because my origin is at the block initially, there is no potential energy initially, but there's a heck of a lot of kinetic energy after the collision. It's moving. And in this state, and in the final state, I don't care about momentum because momentum's not conserved. All I care now is about energy. And in the final state, well, it ain't moving. And because it's not moving, there's only potential energy. And the potential energy is the total mass of the system, which is the bullet plus the block times G times H. See, when I divide it up into pieces like this and I write down exactly what I need for each piece to be satisfied, I don't drop terms. Energy and momentum conservation methods are exceedingly, how should I put it, powerful, but they do require that you pick everything up, that you don't miss any pieces. And since I know the high H, let me start from the back, over. I'm given H, I want to find V0, so let me start with the final process and move to my left. Between the final and the intermediate process, energy is conserved. And thus, 1/2 M bullet plus big M, V squared equals M bullet plus big M, GH. The masses cancel as needed, and I find that the velocity of the block plus a bullet right after the collision, well, I could solve for that here. I move the 2 on that side, I find that V squared is 2GH, and thus V is square root of 2GH. Now, I know H, now I know V, the velocity of the bullet and the block immediately after the collision. And to find V0, I use now the conservation between initial and intermediate states. And that gives P0 equals P intermediate. And thus, MB, V0 equals MB plus big M, V. In other words, V0 equals little m V plus big M V over M V. Now it would be done. Questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, I think I changed notation on you, didn't I? I should have said EI. I put EI. Sorry about that. That is the intermediate energy, isn't it? I meant this should be written as intermediate energy. My mistake. I was just being lackadaisical. You're right, I should put it EI. Questions? In that case, let me start talking about this, an extended body. I won't say too much about it. I'll say what I need to. This is an extended body. It patently cannot, for us, it won't be able to describe it in terms of point particles. It's nice and big like this. The block is as well, by the way. We've been treating an extended body like this as though it was a point particle. Now I'll show you why you can't. Now, this extended body, right, is made out of atoms, many, many, 10 to the 23rd atoms, all connected together. And the fact that it's connected together is important. Because they're all connected together, there will be within this body, when I do this, a whole bunch of internal forces on the system, acting back and forth, keeping this plank in the shape it has. Right? The net effect of all the internal forces between all the atoms within the body back and forth, the net effect is that they all cancel out. Newton's third. The only thing that matters is the external forces on the body as a whole. And we'll show you in a minute why that's true. Now, in this case, the external force is gravity. Right? So I let go, it falls down. And gravity, of course, acts on each little bit of mass in this body. But a net effect of all the forces of gravity on all the little bit of masses that make up this extended body is to make it so that it acts as though it act as the net effect is that gravity will in effect act through one single point. That single point being the center of mass of the body. Now, we know that that's true. Because if my finger wasn't on the center of mass, that my finger wasn't on the point, the one point that gravity acts through, right? This body would tilt over and fall over. Because gravity acts through the center of mass of the body, through one point here, I put my finger directly below at one point, and thus the normal force and the force of gravity will exactly cancel each other out. So that in an extended body like this, gravity only acts through the center of mass. That's why center of mass is also called the center of gravity, because that's the point through which gravity acts. Questions? To see the math, to see it in its full glory, let me, instead of drawing 10 to the third particles, let me just draw a whole bunch of particles. And they're connected to each other through little springs, for example. In other words, there are a whole bunch of internal forces within the atoms inside the body that keeps the shape as the solid shape. Okay? You might say, well, this is an extreme approximation. And that is true. It is. But it's not that bad of a one. A model of a solid like aluminum is actually a pretty good model of a solid like aluminum. Atoms at specific places connected by springs. Sorry. Now I act on the body through an external force. If I look at the force on each individual body, and I'll give them names, I'll call them, this is body 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. If I look, for example, on the force on the ith one, if I apply Newton's second law to the ith one, right? That would be, if I sum up all the forces on the ith particle, well, let's say the fourth one here, I will have the fourth on 4 due to 1 plus the force on the fourth particle due to the seventh particle plus the fourth force on the fourth particle due to the second particle, due to the third particle, and so on, as being the mass of the fourth particle times the acceleration of the fourth particle. But if I now look at, let's say, the second particle, I would have the force on the, the first particle. First force on the first particle due to the second. The force on the first particle due to the fourth. The force on the first particle due to the eighth. That equal to m1a1. And you see here that there is a force on 4 due to 1 and a force on 1 due to 4. Right? And if I add these two equations, these two will cancel out just because of action-reaction pairs. Newton's third, in other words. Right? And I could go on. I could do it for the third particle, the fourth particle, the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, all the particles in the body. Okay? They're all similar except for one, the fifth one. Force on the fifth one. If I look at the fifth body, well, that'll be the force on the fifth body due to the second, plus the fourth on the fifth body due to the sixth, plus the fourth force on the fifth body due to the seventh, plus F external. And that's equal to M5A. Because there's an external force on the body through the fifth mass. Right. So if I add up, and I'll keep on going until I get to the eighth body, right? If I add up all these forces together, right? Add them all up, right? This one will cancel out this one. Right? This one will cancel out. Oh, I dropped one here. I'm sorry. This one will cancel out forces on the second body, and so on. All these internal forces, all the ones that have force on four due to one, force on two due to five, so on, all these external forces will all cancel out because of Newton's third, and all that would have left is the force external equals sum of all masses, ith mass times the ith acceleration. Everybody cool with that? And that means if I look at the sum of the ith mass to the ith acceleration, like we showed on Tuesday, for two particles at least, the sum of all the force, all the masses times the acceleration of each of the bodies, that's just the total mass times a center mass. This is the reason why. That result is the reason why we were okay taking this extended body and treating it as a point particle. Right? Because that equation says, I don't care about the internal forces between the bodies. All I care about is the external force acting on the body. And the body would respond as though it was one mass, one big, huge mass, big M, all centered at the center of mass of the body. That's why we could treat this whole thing as a point particle for all this time. Question? And that means that in order to talk about the forces or the body, how this body responds to external forces, all we really need to do is find out the center mass of the body. Now, that was true also for individual particles like this, right? The difference is that now we have a continuum of particles. We have 10 to the 23rd all connected to each other. Questions? So, how do you find center mass? For an extended body, that is. Suppose I have an extended body. And I'll deal with something that's in three dimensions first. Then we'll talk about lower dimensions. If I have something that's an extended body like this, I want to find its center of mass, which basically means I need to choose a reference point, X, Y, Z. The problem with an extended body like this is that it's an extended body. It's a pain in the ass to work with because it's really big. Now, if it was really small, like this, like individual particles, I know exactly how to calculate its center of mass. I just multiply the position of each object by its mass, add them all up vectorially, and divide by the total mass of the system. I could do it for this too. The reason is, I could slice and dice it. I could cut it up. I'll cut it up into small pieces. Not literally, of course. Mathematically. I will consider this whole body as made up of little bits. Each little bit, when combined together, will give me my original shape. For each little bit, as long as that little bit is small enough, let's say this little bit here, each little bit will have a little bit of mass delta m. Now, it doesn't matter how I divide my masses, but I might as well be smart about and make sure that each of these little bits have the same mass delta m. Each little bit will be a radius r, it's called, from the system. It, of course, depends on where the little bit is. Okay. Now I've changed a continuum problem, a problem with an extended body like this, into a problem I know how to deal with, because they're all just little bit of masses, delta m, at certain positions away from my origin. In which case, the center of mass position now, well, I'll just do exactly what I did here. Here. What I'll do is I'll add up all the little bits. In other words, I'll take the mass of each little bit. I'll multiply by the position of each little bit. And then I'll divide by the total mass of the system. And I'll get back what that total mass is. Oh, heck, I just do it now. And the total mass of the system, I'll know that by adding up, well, each of the small masses together. And that'll tell me what the total mass is, just like I would for individual particles. Now, this works fine as for, this works fine for this choice of small masses. I chose this type of, this big, how little masses delta m are this big. If I really want to get a good value for the center of mass of my original body here, what I really need to do is take this delta m go to zero, smaller and smaller. Because the smaller and smaller these little bits are, the closer and closer in approximation they are to point particles, of course, and the better and better approximation I would have to this, the original body, which is this curved shape and not a square shape. Everybody cool with that? In other words, I have to talk about this. That delta m go to zero, this sum becomes an integral. Okay. And the bottom just becomes an integral. But please, please do realize that this idea where a dm r hat comes from literally just comes from a little bit of mass dm at a radius r from my origin. That's where the physical origins of it is from. Questions? This now is the definition of center of mass for a continuum. And I used to do this in calculus. I'm not sure if they still do it anymore. If I have
a three-dimensional.
The problem here is that this DM is a mass, and this is a position. So in order to really, really do this integral, what I have to do is change this DM into some function of R. Right? And that will depend on my geometry. Because in this case, I have an object in three dimensions. It has a volume associated with it, right? And because it's an object in three dimensions, I know that it will have a density. Remember, density is mass divided by volume. So for objects in three dimensions, I could relate my DM to a coordinate, to a volume, using the density. My mass DM would equal to, well, since the density is equal to mass divided by volume, the density has to be equal to the little bit of mass occupied by a little bit of volume dV. Everybody cool with that? So that's the definition of density. That means for 3D, the little bit of mass is equal to rho dV. Now, the reason I have to use rho is simply because I didn't tell you whether or not that object had constant, I didn't tell you whether that object was uniform or not. It could be that that object had more mass at one point than another point. In other words, it could be that the density depends on position. The density could be functional position, where you are in the body. If you were in two dimensions, a two-dimensional shape, in other words, something nice and flat, then we usually say that instead of talking about the density as being mass per unit volume, we talk about the areal density, the mass per unit area, since that's what's relevant in the problem. We talk about sigma, which is dA dm dA. In other words, this is mass per unit area, so it's the little bit of mass divided by the area it occupies. In which case, dm equals sigma dA. Or, if you're talking about a 1D shape, since now I have my DM, I could put it in here and find that R center mass is the integral of sigma dA, sigma R dA, since that's my, sigma dA is my DM, divided by sigma dA. And if I have a 1D shape, in other words, if I just have a line not filled, just a line, a curve, in 1D, then I would talk about lambda, which is what the book calls the linear density, which is the mass per unit length, ds. And ds is the length along the curve. So I get dm is lambda ds. And putting in dm into that equation, I find that the r center of mass now is integral lambda r ds over integral lambda ds. Now, I have very rarely given, I have not given a center of mass calculation before on an exam, in part because from my perspective, it's calculus. It's not necessarily physics, okay? But I needed to tell you because the book told you. I'll see, have a good weekend. I'll see you on Tuesday.